Welcome to Visible Signs, Invisible Designs. Here we talk about communication design on a meta level. We talk about useful things that people make, but are so humble that they often go unnoticed. Are these designs? Absolutely. Design is more than what meets the eyes. Let's look at what lies beneath the surface. Hello everyone, welcome to Visible Signs, Invisible Designs. This is episode 5, and we have two fantastic guests who are my friends, actually a pair of friends, who are a couple, actually. Dan and Joe, do you want to say hi first?
Hi everyone, this is Joe.
Hi everyone, this is Dan, and thanks for having us, Keith.
No problem. I didn't introduce myself. I always forget that. I'm Keith Tam. I'm the host today. I met Dan and Joe, I think, back in 2019. So that's more than 3 years ago, through a mutual friend, Donna Jones. We've been having very interesting conversations. We've worked together on many different things. And just briefly, Dan and Joe have been involved in UX consultancy work for over 20 years with a long list of really prestigious clients, international. If you are in UX in Hong Kong, you would know that they've been running UX Hong Kong, the conference, for 10 years. It's the 10th anniversary, isn't it, this year? It's very well known in the field, in this part of the world, for sure. And more recently, they've launched Make Meaningful Work, which is a platform or a set of tools that helps people developing 21st century soft skills. I think it's very interesting. They call it from sleepwalking to sparkling at work. And I guess we'll look into that a little bit more today. We're very honored to have Joe and Dan on the show today. So we're going to focus on, I think it's very on topic of the podcast, because we're going to be talking about design, but design as very broadly defined, and we're going to talk a lot about soft skills. We'll get into that. So yeah, Joe, Dan, do you want to briefly introduce yourselves first for our audience?
So I'm Joe, growing up in Hong Kong. I did my tertiary education in Australia. That's where I met Dan. I worked in mainly in advertising, but before UX. So being mainly a researcher in the UX industry for over 10 years. And for the past 10 years, we have this project called Make Meaningful Work. I think we will discuss further during the show.
Great.
Thanks, Joe. Hi, everybody. I'm Dan. I think that's become very obvious so far in the interview, and I've never done this before, but I'm going to talk to my background as related to the invisible design and the visible sign, actually, because I think there's things about in Make Meaningful Work, we have our three pillars, and we talk about character, leadership, and culture, and we have a core tool or a primary tool we call practice spotting that we'll be talking through a little bit today. And we have a series of supporting artifacts or instruments in a journal when you use practice spotting. But at its core, practice spotting very much relates to the title of this show in terms of what is visible and what is invisible and what comes through in design and what do you see as signs. So I think for my background, there are indeed things that are visible in who I am, and there are things that are invisible. But the invisible, or what might be called the tacit or the hidden or the implicit, often are when you get to know people, as Joe and myself have got to know each other, and as we've got to know you, Keith, the invisible parts and the signs that lead us to get to know people more deeply a very, very important part of why we've set up the idea of a Make Meaningful Work studio and what that means in terms of the journeys or adventures related to people's authentic narrative and helping people with that in the use of our tools when they come into the studio. So introduce yourself, right? It's hard, right?
You've gotten into MMW already, which is fine, you know, no problem. But I think the you just reminded me the tree metaphor that you use for practice spotting the branches, the leaves, the you know, that's the visible part, which is the explicit, and then the roots. The implicit, we'll talk a little bit more about practice spotting later. But I guess, you know, let's spend a little bit of time talking about UX first before we get into MMW. Because a lot of people might confuse UX with UI. UI is the visible stuff. But UX is what you guys are really focusing on, the behind-the-scenes stuff, working with people, setting requirements, setting the strategy, the user research side of things. So both Joe and Dan, you know, you guys have a background in information science. How did you find your way into design and specifically UX?
I was running my small Marcom type of little agency in Hong Kong. And Dan came to Hong Kong visiting, and he introduced me to this human factors and usability. And I think at that time, Hong Kong was during this .com type of time.
Yep, I was doing web design then as well.
And I thought, that makes sense. And we gave it a go since then.
That's right. That's part of how it happened. I think when you stick at something long enough, Keith and Joe, and if you're a person who wants to be a continuous learner, I think one way to do that is to grow a very diverse and interesting set of people around you who can inform that. So it almost feels like stepping stones. You know, you go on one stepping stone and you think you have a full understanding of the world until you begin to see the next one and the next one and the next one. And then you realize you don't know very much until it unravels and then you work to the next one. So I think I came all the way back from somewhat interested in technology and systems through the course that we did, but not really that interested in it, frankly, and working in a small IT department at Telecom Australia, or now called Telstra, and then signed up for a job, went for an internal interview for a newly formed usability team working on customer support systems, and then that introduced the whole world of user-centered design and human factors, and had an absolutely superb team on every level, and that can often make or break a person's professional journey if they're lucky enough to be immersed with fantastic people.
Oh, that's the most important. It's
really important. And then that led to the widening of the field when I moved to Hong Kong, and Joe, being who she is, very, very open and intelligent and courageous lady, she took this on, and we pursued that for a number of years, and then that evolved into user experience and starting UX Hong Kong. And then I think Joe, more so than myself, I've kind of evolved as a more interested and curious person. It then worked. We were hitting boundaries, professional and personal boundaries with user experience. So we needed something else. Something appetizing or tantalizing to think about. And it took us about 2 years to even come up with a question of how we can make meaningful work. But I'm realizing that is now, after about 10 years on this, it's now evolving into not necessarily a new project, but it's certainly evolving into territory related to value systems and models and tackling very difficult problems and helping people personally navigate that complexity and helping people take ownership of that in their narratives. And it's all iterative. We're improving as we go through it as in terms of facilitating it. But the fun of it is working with people like you, Keith, and other people that can contribute to the improvement of the tools and improvement of the studio experience and improvement of the program. So I feel like we're continuing to evolve and learn and mature, which is all, I think, makes life and work very interesting.
Yeah, I guess, you know, make meaningful work is also UX. It's also, we're talking about experiences very much. So I guess it's quite natural. But you guys came up with Make Meaningful Work quite a while back, right? When did this name come about? Like after you set up your consultancy in UX, how many years into that did you come up with this name?
So it started with that we have been involved in all these industry conference and learnings and after about 10, 15 years, we started to observe the pattern of we keep talking about tools and we just keep talking about it and keep talking about the same things.
And sometimes the same things with different names, but those different names are appearing to be something new when they're not necessarily...
Like put a different label on things. Mm. And with all these projects that we've worked with different teams and different corporations from different parts of the world, we started to observe sometimes teams are not working well together.
Right.
And...
So through your consultancy work in UX, you observed how organizations operated, right?
Yeah.
And you identified these issues.
Yeah. Mm. And then we started to wonder, because we at one point we were thinking to maybe we should do a PhD or master's of some kind of design-related stuff. And when we talked to some of our senior colleagues, and they were saying like, not really suitable for you guys. So after we observed these issues that surrounding us, especially the damage that not good for people's health, which I'm very passionate about.
Toxic environments.
Yeah.
At work.
It affects your immune system, and then you get sick a lot, and it's just not good. So we started to talk to people around us and basically around the world about what are they doing. And I think for the first 2 years or so, we were trying to figure out, are we talking about integrated teams? Are we talking about different ingredients of things that needs to happen in projects? Are we talking about all these different different things that needs to happen in corporations? Because we often involve in projects that it's not just different departments within the corporations. It's also different vendors. From different parts of the world, because I'm not
complex relationships.
Yeah, it's very complex. Sometimes tech teams is in this country and design teams in this country and something like that. I'm not sure about the timing though.
It was about 2012 when we went to Chengdu with our good friends Baz and Heke. Yeah, because we were discussing with them as friends and colleagues about what we were observing
yeah.
in the way you described it. And that's what good friends and colleagues are for. They serve as a sounding board. And it also
conversations
absolutely
are where these things happen.
Absolutely,
these good things happen.
Like the many great ones we have had with you, Keith, and will continue to have. And then people bring different perspectives to it. But what we came back to our office with after that trip with Buzz and Hecker is we came away with this drawing that we had, and I've still got it somewhere. And what it allowed us to do, and then I'll hand back to Joe, it allowed us to do something very simple but powerful. What it allowed us to do is understand the system or at least the beginnings of an ecosystem at play that helped, interestingly enough, Keith, I was chatting with Dawna Jones just before our call today.
Oh, was that right? Okay.
Yep, I was. And we were talking about a couple of interesting areas that we could go deeper on, and one of them that she mentioned was a contextual awareness or a contextual sensitivity but what that plays into, and I'll bring it back on point, is the understanding or the being able to see a system at play. And I think that's become such an important part of, not unique to, but such an important part of Make Meaningful Work, because organizational dynamics plus other dynamics that are happening in the world are getting in the way and causing almost like a blindness or a short-term mentality that is further getting in the way of remodeling and solving big problems like health, which Joe describes, and also climate.
Yep.
Anyway, with that said, I'll hand back to Joe.
So rehealth, if you're not feeling well and the environment is not that positive, I think at the end of the day, you need to make a lot of decisions at work.
Yeah.
If you're in that type of environment and you're not feeling well, the chances of making good decisions is lower.
Yeah, right. And I think the siloing of different teams and departments actually make everybody kind of just focusing on a small area without communicating with each other. They just do what they are told to do without losing sight of the contextual aspects, right?
Keith, I knew there's a reason we love working with you. That is precisely what the Make Meaningful Work Studio is intended to do. Now, not necessarily studio in the design studio sense of the word, although that's fine. It's more like a movie studio in the sense of the word, that when a director and a producer and a camera person and a sound person and a stage manager and whatever other roles are involved come together, they come together very explicitly and work together very explicitly at the intersections to create, hopefully, some magic in form of a song or a movie or a TV special or whatever that is. And we've realized that instead of talking at a process level about things like organizational change or transformation, why not explicitly create a studio that inserts itself at the intersections in between these silos and acts as a bridging point? And if you can do that effectively, like we're doing at HKDI, and you can start to bring these different disciplines into a space and make something together, and in our case it's helping with storytelling and making associated with storytelling, suddenly you don't have to necessarily talk about or you can let go some of that organisational, the problematic behaviours that are created by silos, and suddenly people are, what do we call it? We say communicating, collaborating and curating. And it's magic. There's nothing better. It's just fantastic when it works well.
Making. I really like that word, actually. That word immediately spoke to me because you need to put that into action. It's not talking about meaningful work. It's about doing it. I want to come back to Joe's point about health, though.
Please.
Toxicity. I can't say that word, toxic environment at work. I guess what you mean by health is more than just, you know, overloaded with work or burnout. It's deeper than that, isn't it?
Correct. So in terms of health, this I'm very much into Chinese medicine, traditional Chinese medicine. We often in the modern Western style of medicine, we often silo ourselves. You get all these different specialists and looking at different things. If you're mentally not well, you need to see this specialist and all that. But in terms of traditional Chinese medicine, you need to see a person as a whole because it's all interconnected. Yep. And also, the most important thing is you're connected to the nature. You need to do things according to the nature's clock, not just human's clock. And when we in a environment that's all disconnected, it has very negative impact on everybody. It's not just one person. When you're not well, you're affecting the person next to you, and then it's like a river that is just affecting everybody along the way. As we talking to people around the world about how they deal with their problems, we started to see a pattern that everyone's in different contexts. But everyone is using their bag of tricks to deal with all these problems. So it's almost like your own immunity gives you that strength or ways to deal with things. So that's how we cover all these. Keith deal with things in this environment, but most what Keith has been using is implicit. So all these underlying things so I see a lot of parallel of how people dealing with issues in the workplaces and also in the health of your body itself. Because in Chinese medicine, you have all these qi and blood that flowing around you that we can't really see, but qi and the blood is almost the most crucial things that in your body that gives you nutrients, bring you oxygens and takes your waste away. That's not seen,
but you know, I think it's fair to say one knows when you're in an environment that's toxic or unhealthy, and you know what you feel like when you're in an environment. And usually the primary problem or the cause of that toxicity is other people.
And
you also equally know when you're in wonderful and energetic and environments that feel more conducive to making meaningful work. You know what that looks and feels like. The problem we've got is that we've got more cases associated with toxicity than we do meaningful work. So I know I'm repeating here the explicitness of the third chapter of the book we wrote, that was the late, it's chronologically the third chapter, but we didn't have a third chapter. We thought we've got to call out the space. And the word making, I'm pleased you like it, Keith, because we could have said design, but the problem is then it makes it feel like this is my bias, but I feel like if we would have used the word design, it just doesn't feel as accessible or as approachable, because suddenly people think, oh, maybe I need to be a designer, which could be problematic. So when we say make, it felt that the studio itself, the Make Meaningful Work studio, plus the use of practice spotting, plus the idea of making in that space, primarily making your authentic narrative with the use of practice spotting feels approachable and accessible.
Definitely.
Back to Jai.
Yeah, because everybody can identify. But can we move, because I think this is a good jumping off point to talk about the character card, because you're starting from the person,
yeah,
right? The self.
Yeah.
I know in the front of the book you have Sou Shen Cai Ga Ji Guo Ping Tin Ha, right? Do you want to speak a little bit about that? Why do you want to start with a character card? What is a character card, actually?
So we've got quite a few character cards in the character card section of the journal. So in the book we have one in there as one.
Yeah.
Character card.
Mm-hmm.
It's related to what you just said in Chinese. It's from Confucius, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a thinking about how we, as a human being in this in this world or on this planet, how should we behave?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at the philosophers in the West and in the East, in terms of Chinese philosophers, they observe the nature and how people should fit in.
Mm-hmm.
The Western philosophers that I read about, they almost mostly observe about human behaviors. So the connection of you and the nature that, or the context that you're living in, from the Chinese philosophers, is very much connected. The connectedness is
yep.
like the Chinese medicine as well. Is everything is connected. So the everything starts from you.
But it doesn't mean it doesn't mean it's all about you.
Definitely.
Starts with you.
Yeah. So The Chinese words that you mentioned is you need to start to improve yourself first, but that
yep.
you just talk about much deeper things like values and all those inner compass that you need to have. So
yep.
to almost manifest to people around you and then your society and then your nation as a whole. So everything mm-hmm. starts from one person. So that's why we started from character card. You need to
yeah.
Be more aware of who you are, accept it, and keep improving the things that you want to improve.
But there's
Asian cultures are very, it's a very well documented or, well known fact that we really value context in everything we do. So that kind of speaks a lot to the Asian kind of characteristics, cultural characteristics.
It does, Keith. But I wanted to say that there's a practicality to this, or a pragmatism associated with this, because I can
mm-hmm.
I'm listening to Jo and I know her so well and I know where she's coming from, but I'm also thinking about our audience. And think about if our audience would be listening to this, they would think that we're talking about spirituality here without application.
Right.
And it's not that at all. Actually, it's the opposite.
Yeah.
So what we're saying, I
love it. Very practical.
It's
actually.
Very practical, actually. Now, I want to talk to how it's practical. So I love this quote. I don't know where it came from. People can Google it. But the quote is, action creates progress. Progress creates momentum. And momentum creates motivation. Now, it's easy. One could say in our 3Ms, we start with motivation, but the motivation has to come from an action. Joe always talks repeatedly about it's words to action. You've got to move it into a do. So what we've tried to do is link it all together. So how do we link it all together? If it starts from a place of character, then the usually characters have associated with them stories. And those stories will translate and map to an authentic narrative. And then those narratives can be made up of practices or soft skills that are then connected or mapped to a set of values. So in other words, what we're really talking about here is an awareness of why do you do what you do?
Yeah.
And I'm trying to continuously understand that and have intention in what I do. And that doesn't mean that I'm always trying to orchestrate what I do. Mm-hmm. The idea of having intention behind what you do as related to your character and as it connects to the practices and the underlying values and the motivators is a big deal. And that and that requires practice. So where do you practice that? Well, you can only practice that if you have a space to practice it, a reflective space to practice that. And that's what the studio is all about. So coming back to character, and that's why I don't want to just talk about character as a siloed thing.
Yep.
Character is part of our journaling. It is connected to your narrative, but the implication is character goes way beyond just filling out a character card. The intention of a character card is to help understand yourself a little better, and it's also contextually there to help understand more about the people that you're making with together so you can get on and have more sparkle and less sleepwalking.
You talk about authenticity quite a bit. Tell us a little bit more about why authenticity is so important.
Well, I am going to go first here briefly, and then I'll hand to Joe. But one take on authenticity is actually what Joe talks also quite a lot about, is this idea of self-acceptance. And it's not self-acceptance like F-U, self-acceptance, like, oh, it's my way or the highway, or it's a belligerent form of self-acceptance. But it's a self-acceptance in being comfortable with yourself enough to be generous in helping others, which comes back to it's not all about you. So that's part of where I think authenticity comes from. But I'll hand over to Joe to talk about it as well.
It relates to the context that we create for ourselves. I think a lot of the times the education system we go through, the society we're in,
tells us who to be.
Yeah, it's almost like these templates you need to follow, and these are the things that you should be doing. And we, I think along the way, we lose ourselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's why
you are a screw in a big machine rather than you're, you know, a unique person who contributes in a unique way.
Exactly. That's why we start with character, that because I think we disconnect a lot of the things, including all these major decisions we made that are not connected to our values and all those core things that inside us. We can see the impact, like we're living on a sick planet because all these disconnect decisions that we make along the way. We made decisions because of solely financial decisions, that is
not profit motive and growth.
Yeah, not connected with the values we've got, right? A lot of people in corporations made their decisions in isolation with their true self.
But it's it's imposing though, Keith and Joe. It's very imposing because depending on where you grow up, because it depends.
Yeah.
But if you're growing up in a society, a value set that's baked into the education system and also baked into industry, that says this is the rule set and this is the set of values that are equal to a success. And if you feel like you won't prescribe to that, equal to the measures that come with that too, the so-called, excuse this language, the KPIs, the key performance.
I was going to say that, but And, well, now we have a different KPI, which is ESG. Right.
Well, that's
But even, to measure those things.
even that can be bastardized to
register something
else. Right. So, coming back to character and the idea of authenticity is, I think authenticity comes when we encourage spaces, facilitated spaces, to allow people to have a voice, sometimes in the things that people don't want to hear, equal to the prospective models that we should be walking towards. And in fact, I just had this conversation with Dawna this morning. I find it becomes incredibly frustrating, especially when you live with someone like Jo. She's not frustrating, but what's frustrating is when things she opens up possibilities on what can be healthier. What's frustrating is when other people can't see it and they keep describing to the very models that look like models of success, but in fact they're models of damage.
Yes. Well, I think I don't know if we're opening a whole, you know, other can of worms here, because, you know, what if there's a misalignment between your values and the company's values? You know, what if there's a misalignment there? What happens? But I guess we'll save that for another show, because that's a big thing.
I want to add this before we move to the next topic. I think it's because people are not bring all these values and beliefs more explicitly talk about.
Yeah, right.
Right? Yeah. If everyone knows, say for example, in the senior leadership, we are not that different because our values is basically the same. It's just how we behave or how we do things on the surface it looks different, right?
It's a very good point, Jo, just and then hand back to Key. It's a very good point because if things go unspoken, especially in reference to values, you might be making assumptions about the distance or of the gap between what you think and how you think of others. And again, coming back to practice spotting, that's the whole idea of the process of practice spotting, to help understand perspectives that might be hidden, as Jo said, implicitly in the tree, Keith, that you mentioned. And then you can determine, once that's more visible, in the invisible, that becomes more visible, and there's signs, I'm playing into the topic of today, the show title, there's signs that are showing us where there are connections and disconnections, then you can determine if a place is right for you where you work. But you don't really know that until that becomes more, the signs become more visible.
Yeah, well, I agree. I agree with what you guys just said. We need to talk about these things. We need to talk about values and meaning. It's not often that we talk about that. We talk about the transactional things, the everyday operational stuff that we need to get done. We talk about KPIs, but it's rare that we talk about meaning or values. Let's talk more about the tree. I think that's the centerpiece of what Make Meaningful Work it's all about. It's a tool called Practice Spotting. Tell us a little bit about that. And why is storytelling so important in this?
So it connects back to the story where this come from. So after we observe all these people, how they solve their problems, we thought, everyone's using their own bag of tricks. But these bag of tricks include all these values and beliefs, soft skills or competencies. These are all things that's under the surface of what you see.
Mm-hmm.
And these things, we thought, it's very interesting that we don't have a way to acquire these soft skills or transferable soft skills, right? Keith might pick up some things from your parents, your teachers, or your bosses, your colleagues. And if I met someone or some people different along my path, I'll pick up different things, right? But when we pick up, it's also implicit. We're just influenced by these people that we met. And how much you absorbed from these people is also different. It depends on whether you're even aware to pick these up. or learn from these people. So that's why we thought it's almost like that's why we use the tree analogy. It's like trees, right? All you see is the above the soil stuff, right? Nice things. But for something nice to have or to grow a healthy tree, you need really good soil, roots, deep roots, the right environment for it, the right nutrients and water, and et cetera.
So Keith, bridging from that, when I was about 12 years old, in growing up in Melbourne, at school they started in Form 1, Form 2, they started drama classes.
Yeah.
And suddenly we went from a traditional classroom environment with blackboards and chairs, and, you know, you can picture the typical classroom for an English-based school system, to a portable outside the building, and no tables and chairs, and just a little open, you know, open space within the portable. And suddenly we're in a different environment, and we were doing different, our drama teacher was taking us through very different activities to explore our character effectively. And I don't just mean that in the development of character to play a character, but actually just our own character.
Right.
And then my drama teacher recommended me and a couple of others to the National Theatre in Melbourne. And so I went to drama school for 4 years. And
great.
And so what I observed, particularly in drama school, was I observed less outgoing kids who suddenly were expressing themselves. And I was seeing sides of their character in their performance that I'd never seen. You would just never know, right? And you watch these kids mature, including your own development, right? And so when I think about practice spotting, not only, but an important part of the tool is this idea of unrealized potential. It's this idea of bringing out talent in people, but where that is represented through stories that feel authentic to the individual. So they can take ownership of that, and they feel like they have a free will in that. I was reading an article just this morning talking about the relationship between depression and free will, and I can send this to you after the interview, but it was saying that people that tend to feel that they have more free will and more control in driving that have less bouts of depression, which is it's just a very interesting data point. So practice spotting is not just there on its own. It's there to inform the narrative and to help bring the implicit and make it explicit in all the ways Joe described, but to actually feel that people feel like they've got more energy and they're in the driver's seat in reference to their own narrative. Now, in terms of the process side of that, we continue to run through the process of practice spotting with people, and it's really as simple as currently. It's as simple, I say it's as simple, but the steps are, without going into detail, you start with an observation, and an observation could be a problem that a person is facing or a challenge, or it could be not a problem. It could be another type of observation.
So you're talking about moments, different moments that you encounter.
The moments will come then from step two, which is the stories that naturally come from the observation. Then in step three, the moments. And then we begin to do the deeper unpacking of the moment. And then from the unpacking of the moment, we get to a practice. And then the person feels like, okay, now I'm getting a clearer identification through practice spotting, what practices matter and what outcomes I seek that can or cannot be measured that relate all the way back to the authentic narrative. And all through this, I come back to my narrative, which suddenly every time I do practice spotting, I promise you both, every time I do it, I'm that 12, 11-year-old kid again in the cubicle at my school. And I'm suddenly thrust into an environment where I'm working with people who actually care enough about my character to see my potential and see my character traits just through different lenses. And that's exactly what practice spotting is intended to do. And I don't know what to call that. I don't know what to call that facilitation or leading or practice spotting. Mm. But what it does is the outcome of it has the same look and feel, which is you can see people waking up from a sleeping state, and then they start to work out, okay, I'm feeling energized towards what my narrative is equal to sparkle. And you know what, Keith? It doesn't have to be a drawn-out process. That can happen literally within 15 to 20 minutes of one studio session, and that's why the tool itself is so powerful.
Yeah, I think I like the idea that you can learn from any observation, from anyone, right?
Yep.
So the stories can come from anywhere, basically. It can come from your own experiences. It can come from, you know, like a football game. The first time I remember we did practice spotting with you guys. You can learn from any kind of situation if you observe deeply.
That's it. And if I were to apply an organizational setting here, the idea is if everybody has a clearer understanding of each other's authentic narrative, and we've all got a clearer understanding of our respective practices, that can go into a shared library or repository of stories and practices, and suddenly we've got a more visible view into what makes up the character, leadership, and culture of an organization, which is the visibility into those three pillars that are interconnected. Rather than culture and leadership being this abstract, fuzzy thing that people feel they have no voice in.
Because everybody would have ownership, because everybody would have contributed stories and also helped practice spotting from other stories, right? So it's important that other people practice spot
absolutely
a story, because we will have multiple lenses to look at the same story and we'll have different takeaways, right?
Exactly.
I mean, and those can be generalized so that everybody can apply in their own unique situations.
Exactly. And it has a multiplier effect. And whether that's called co-creation or making or crowdsourcing, it's that energy, that good energy in that experience that you feel when you're all making something together, and you start to get to the connections in those intersections. That's the magic of it, I found.
We've experienced that firsthand with our team of lecturers in our retreat. You know, we create a library of practices and stories.
Right,
can be very simple. It can be it's not a complicated, you know, drawn out system, as you said. Yeah,
and I think it's also very very reflective process without people telling you off, right?
Right.
I'll give you a story very quickly. Like yesterday, Wing was telling us about her story
Who is Wing?
Wing was your ex-student.
And working,
as a designer.
Wing has been working on the graphic design for MMW for a while now.
She has been trying to apply on her life. So she's still studying, right? And she was telling us yesterday that, in my tutorial, there was this girl in my group, because they're doing some projects together, that she's very outspoken at the tutorial time, give a lot of advice and suggestions to what she observed, because I think they need to practice their presentation and things like that. And she was telling us, when I observe this girl in my class, I thought maybe I should pay more attention in class, right? And contribute more in the class to give other people suggestions, so I can learn from them as well as we can learn from each other.
So that's Wing's application of practice spotting, and
that's great.
That's Wing's reflection on how it plugged into her own narrative, and that's what it's about.
And plus she has an action to take.
That's it.
She wants to do.
That's it. Right? That she wants to do. That's the key point, right?
And what plays into her, one of the things that she thinks that she has gaps is she's a little bit passive. I said to her, that's great, because that will narrow the gap of passiveness, because you actually want to contribute in class.
So Keith, I would say, and then I've got a question for you, actually. It's a bit counterintuitive, isn't it? The guest asking you.
No problem. It's a conversation. No problem at all.
But I wanted to say, this is where with enough practice, a big word here, but the mastery, right? I think the mastery is, and this is what I love about Make Meaningful Work in particular, is it's very easy just to look at a list of 21st century soft skills, you know, from World Bank or... As you said,
World Economic Forum, top 10 skills for 2025. Yeah. Yeah.
Or another list of competencies that come from another framework. There's hundreds of them, right? But the trap is that you can blindly then just adopt a particular practice soft skill competency into a context, but it's not the right fit. So the practices or the mastery becomes, if you actually get better at practice spotting, what you can do is realize one of our three A's across adaptability, alignment, and authenticity, which is the adaptability part of it, which is to say, okay, I can actually very quickly draw upon a practice that I need here. It might be new, write a new practice, or it might be one that fits within your own library. But the idea of it is you can apply it, you can recognize it and apply it quickly, and then seek the outcome that you're looking for. And what you notice in sport, in theatre, I mean, in so many pursuits, the masters tend to be the ones that can, they actually know ahead of time what the library of practices are, but they're also incredibly flexible to be able to draw on one, even if it's one they're not so expert in. They'll still draw upon it, they'll learn something, and then they'll refer to someone else to help them practice that.
Well, that's it, right? Everybody's different. Everybody's strengths are different.
That's right.
Everybody's needs are different in terms of development. But in any case, you know, a growth mindset is very important in all of this. If you don't have that, it's kind of difficult to get into all of this.
That's right.
But so this tool really helps you to be more, thinking more in terms of growth.
Now, that lends itself to my question for you, or our question for you, which I just thought of. In the spirit of the growth mindset, in the spirit of continuous learning, because clearly we share a lot of values and intentions and practices between the three of us. Just quickly, what was it about practice spotting specifically that you found so useful? Because you seem to take it on and apply it very quickly, and you saw it as something that would work well for other people. So what was it for you?
Well, because I'm a strong believer that you can learn from anything that we see if we look close enough. And I remember one of the teachers wrote in the the little book that everybody wrote in when you graduate primary school. Knowledge is everywhere you look, basically. This really, you know, it has been really memorable for me, and I've been taking it to heart. And this is it, really. It's practice spotting, isn't it? So I identify with it right away. And I think it was interesting that you can take a movie clip and really take it apart and really understand what's going on in there. Or you can tell your own stories, or when you hear somebody telling a story, there's so much to unpack, even when, you know, on the surface it sounds very simple or very trivial. There's a lot in there. So I immediately identified with practice spotting soon as you introduced it to me.
That's awesome. I'm pleased I asked the question, because for the audience listening in, I mean, I've never actually, from what I can recall, have heard you say that before. And I'm also thinking in the studios that we have coming up at HKDI, it might be worth you sharing that with other people, so they can see that as part of your authentic narrative, which is interesting.
Yeah. Well, it's almost an hour, believe it or not. We've talked about a lot of things. Maybe we should wrap up and let's see. what else do we want to pick out in the last 5 minutes or so? I put here, it's a bit of a big topic. I mean, education obviously needs shifting because we have so much going on in terms of technology. The most recent hot topic is ChatGPT, how that's going to change everything, but in an education setting as well. I mean, how do we even prepare graduates so that they are future ready or future proof? Name a couple of really core soft skills. What do you think they would be to prepare graduates for the future?
Let's hear from Joe and then I'll close, I suppose.
I think I will go back to Confucius saying the Sao san cai ga zi guo ping ting ha. That's just a summary of the thinking behind it. What he was talking about basically is, well, human beings, you need to work from deep inside you first. Because I think even with all these technologies like AI, you need humans, I don't want to say governance, but almost like a values stake, measurement. Because that's how we almost survive for so many thousands of years in civilization. If we don't have that and just let technology go wild, we might destroy ourselves.
I think what the takeaway for me for that is, because so many issues that we have in the world now, they're all systemic. I mean, including the way we think about work, the way we think about money or profit, or the way we think about consumer culture and things like that, they're all very they're all systemic issues. And I think the quote really says a lot about the connections on a systemic kind of way, how these things relate from the starting from the person.
That goes back to the beginning of our conversation about why we started with character card and values, those things, because all these soft part of our human beings, we almost like forgot for the past few hundred years, and we need to remind ourselves to bring that back. Sometimes when we in workshops, people might have this assumption that we think all these hard skills and tools are not important. That's that's not the case. It's just that we are way off balance. Making all these decisions.
Of course, we need to rethink the hard skills too. Right.
Keith, I was listening to Joe and you, and I was revisiting the World Economic Forum on those on that list that they put together, and there's plenty of these types of lists available relating to practices, competencies, soft skills. A couple of notes. First one is the word soft skill, like the definition of it, because I've seen in so many different publications, I've seen the word or the examples of soft skill being used in so many different ways.
Yeah.
Where sometimes I've seen people use leadership as a soft skill.
Yeah.
I would say leadership is a category. It's not a soft. A soft skill to me, without getting into the definitions game, a soft skill has to be very specific. and very practical in its use, whereas leadership feels it just sounds too big. Then I had a look through the list in the World Economic Forum, and there's a mix of categories and soft skills and other things going on there.
Yeah, problem solving, self-management, working with people, technology use and development.
Yeah.
Those are the four main categories.
Indeed. And then I had a look at our top 10 in our book, which starts from enable active listening all the way down to make meaningful decisions. And there's a run-on effect and a specific order to this equal to what helps people be better people, what helps people be better humans. And so I think, to Joe's point, I think something like ChatGPT or other AI-based tools will continue to be wonderful complements to better thinking and better decision-making and help people make better, more meaningful decisions. But at the end of the day, prior to the output, there is a thing called sense-making. Prior to the output, we're not privy to what's necessarily going on prior to the output. The output is what the AI or Google kind of blurts out on a results page. But what's interesting is in the studio, what's interesting is coming back to the storytelling and the conversations and the practice spotting is that's interesting. Why did Keith arrive at that? Well, let me ask Keith a bit more about that.
Yeah.
Joe, what was it about, you know? And what you do is you're applying different lenses and different questions as you move through practice spotting to get to that. So if I were to, just for today, if I were to pick one soft skill from all the lists, I have to go all the way back to the beginning and pick the active listening one.
Yeah.
Because when you're using a search or an AI-based chat tool, whatever it's called, how do we know what it's listening out for? And it's going to be very dependent on what you type in, but what you type in can be very, very restrictive. Whereas human to human, you can explore, you can go down different branches, but what's implied is you have to get better at listening.
Yeah, what's right.
Being said. And so the question becomes, and maybe this is a good place to hand back to you, is that AI is listening, but is it listening? Is it really listening out for the right things?
Right. Yeah, that's right. I think active listening is a great. Is going to be increasingly important. I absolutely agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I tried the. It's not ChatGPT. I downloaded an app that we can use in Hong Kong, and I asked it to write the script for our podcast, and it did it. You know, it really broke it down into, you know, minutes. You know, the host asking questions and then the guest answering, you know, it's creepy, really. Yeah. We should try to just read out that script and do a show like that and see what happens.
I'd be up for that. Sounds great.
But, you know, I think the thing is there's spontaneity in our conversation today. You know, we wrote a script. We didn't write a script. We wrote some questions to prompt our conversation, but you know, it took its own course because we were listening out, you know, for each other. We responded differently, impromptu, you know, in real time.
But a
script would never be able to do.
Indeed, but I would say in reference, because you brought up, you know, ChatGPT and AI in the studio context and what we're about to embark upon at HKDI. Let the AI be a player in the creative process. That's fine. It's just that we don't always have to listen for it.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And then it would be a matter of, you know, we sift through all the information and, you know, assess the information and choose, you know, what's relevant and ignore the rest, you know. That...
Like any good curation process.
Yes, part of the that's right. Exactly. Curation is going to be important because, you know, AI can generate a lot of art as well, but, you know, it can generate a lot of crap. You need to sift through that crap to find the gems. Yeah.
I think the thing that in Chinese language, we talk a lot about the heart.
Yeah.
you don't use your brain to study, you use your heart to study, because you want to study, you want to learn, right? Like, 你心機讀書啦, right? You're not like, 用個腦, whatever. There's a lot to do with your heart, which I think for the time being, it's really hard to get that into AI system, right?
For sure, yeah.
So I think to build our heart muscles and that side of things, I think it's more important than any other time, because all these decisions we made for the past few hundred years are disconnected with our heart, more connected with other material and capitalistic way. We just need to pivot.
And Keith, and to hand back to you, Keith, but there feels it's a tension. And I still feel the tension in Make Meaningful Work and in the studio sessions. The tension is, especially if you've got the good fortune to facilitate and help others, the tension is what's in it for me, and also what becomes generous in intention. And I'm hoping we're tipping the scales more towards generosity, not because it's a feel-good exercise, but the generosity through the narratives, the generosity through the practice spotting, the generosity through the practices, the generosity in the movement towards the collective value that comes from that.
Collaboration.
Collaboration and the ability to see things together holistically and then refocus on the problem areas that are actually problem areas that we need to do the meaningful work on.
I think more focus on heart, definitely. And collaborate with AI for what's appropriate. Ethics would become a big issue, I think. Huge issue. I think we're moving away. In education, we've moved away from learning about facts for a long time, really.
That's right.
AI is very good at that. It can gather all the facts, and well, we don't know about the sources though, for us. But it's no longer about that anyway. We're not regurgitating facts anyway. Creativity is going to be important.
Yep.
Right? Because AI can only create from what has been created before, not That's new it. Things. And AI cannot, I mean, I hope AI won't make decisions for us, because that's going to be very, you know, that's going to be very dangerous. And I think, you know, big decisions still need to be made by human beings, I think.
I think that's
because there's a lot of morals and ethics involved in some of the decisions that we make.
But I think that's the distinction, right? Like, we've spoken a lot today about context and being contextual. Like, I'm actually okay with AI making some decisions. It just depends what they're making decisions on.
Yeah. Depends. Not the big decisions that affect humanity, for sure. So, tell us a little bit about UX Hong Kong. The first virtual session started last week. What are the plans?
Great question. So people can visit uxhongkong.com, and we did kick off last week. So people go to the site, they can click on the program. What we're doing is we've got 8 online sessions planned for this year to celebrate our 10 years. And we kicked off last week with Andrea Resmini, session 1. And his topic was on...
Yeah, it was great.
Thank you. On making meaningful spaces, because we've spoken quite a lot about that today. We have Susan Wolf, session 2, coming up, and her topic is UX strategy. And that's going to be on the 23rd of March, 2023. It's going to be 6 to 7:30 p.m. Sydney, Australia time, and kick off at 3 p.m. Hong Kong time, and people can register for that. And then what we'll be doing, Keith, will be tantalizingly announcing the next 2 speakers for every quarter at a time. So Q2 coming soon, we have our next 2 speakers set for session 3, design leadership, And for session four, comfortable with uncertainty, pardon me. So we've got all of the topics on the program page. And then at the end of the year, we've got a in-person event at Hong Kong Design Institute, and that will be a way to talk holistically at the key insights that we got from each session that have been aggregated on all the Miro boards that will be created. And that's currently planned for the 24th of November at the Hong Kong Design Institute. And that will be a lovely way to bring everything together for UX Hong Kong. And then we'll plan, if the experiment works, and it appears to be working well as a series of online events, we may very well stick to this format for the years to come, with making it a whole year thing, distributed events over a year, and finish with an in-person event or conference. And now with better news about the pandemic and COVID,
yeah,
it might be that going into 2024, we may be able to return to have international people come in and visit us, which would be great.
Very exciting. Very exciting. And very happy to be working with you both.
Thank you. I was about to say thank you so much for the support for this year. Yeah.
My pleasure. And thank you so much for being on the show today. We know it won't be the last time. There'll be many more because there's so much to unpack. I mean, we've barely scratched the surface today with what you guys are doing with MMW. So, yeah, thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you for having us, Keith.
Thanks a lot, Keith, and wishing you a really great weekend and day ahead.
You too. Well, thank you very much for listening. So see you next time. You've been listening to Visible Signs, Invisible Designs. Thanks for tuning in. If you like this episode, please subscribe. You can find the show on anchor.fm, Spotify, or Apple Podcast. Until next time.